So the first three verses of Revelation, they go like this. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his servants the things that must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw. Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear and who keep what is written in it, for the time is near. I'm going to be honest, Eric. I know it says I'm blessed or blessed. I never know which one it is if I read it. But I'm also a little skittish because Revelation is confusing and weird. And I think there's a dragon in there. And it all has gotten very scary when people talk about Revelation.
And that's unfortunate, really.
So I might need some convincing to help me figure out why this is not the scariest book in the Bible. Can you help with that?
We can do that.
Okay. My name's May, and Revelation scares me.
And my name's Eric, and I used to read Revelation every week instead of listening to the sermon when I was a kid. And this is Too Long Didn't Read.
Too Long Didn't Read is an irreverent look at a reverent book. It's a podcast about the Bible. And this is a between seasons one-off special on everyone's favorite piece of apocalyptic literature. This is a deep dive into the book of Revelation. It's not an easy book to understand. It's violent, scandalous, even downright weird. But it's part of the Bible for a reason. Wonder why? So do we.
A seven-headed beast, a harlot riding a seven-headed beast, and that's the easy stuff. Revelation can be daunting, but underneath the imagery, there's an incredible message. Forget everything you've ever learned about Revelation, and for the love, please forget Left Behind.
I can't.
You can. I believe in you. Today, on a special Too Long Didn't Read, it's a primer and overview on the final book of the Bible, Revelation.
Okay, so can I tell you what I know about Revelation?
Sure.
All I know is, or what I think I know, is that it is telling me what is going to happen at the end of the world, and it does not sound fun. In fact, I think I'd like to be gone before any of that stuff goes down.
The end of the world as we know it.
Cue the music.
That's your
Can
job.
We afford that? No, we
Probably
can't
not.
Afford
no,
that.
No, we okay. can't afford that.
Sing it in your head.
Not in the budget.
Is that even close to accurate?
Yes and no. On one hand, to talk about Revelation means to talk about, like, what is this book supposed to be in the first place? It's a little unusual because for most of the Bible, you have really familiar types of literature. You know, in the New Testament, there's lots of letters, which even though they're written to groups of people in most cases, like, we know what a letter is. Like, there's parts of a letter, like, there are greetings to certain people and instructions and all that. And then there's poetry elsewhere and, you know, historical accounts of things and all of this stuff that's pretty familiar to us. But when it comes to Revelation, it's a little bit different. Like, this is a genre that we don't really have in modern times. It's called apocalyptic literature. And so it reads kind of like narrative, but it's weird. And so we don't really know what parts of it should I interpret as reality. Is this a metaphor? Is this just symbolism? Is there really a dragon, or does that dragon mean something else? And so, like, to read it just sitting down without any kind of context, you get one of two reactions to it. It's either like, oh, that's really weird, I'm just going to ignore it, which is a shame because there's a lot of really important stuff in it. Or people obsess about it and they try to figure out what every single thing means, and then you end up paranoid and looking for signs and proofs and all this sorts of stuff that doesn't really help you get to the main point of it anyway.
Is it even meant to be figured out? Like, does every picture and sign, does it correlate to something?
I think when John wrote Revelation, he intended for the events in the book to correlate to things. But I don't think that giving an account of here's this series of events was his primary goal. I think his primary goal was, I want to give the followers of Jesus hope for what is the end game in the midst of difficult circumstances that they're currently facing.
So Is revelation like a dream, like something that John heard from God and then told everyone else through this book, through this apocalyptic literature?
That's how it's presented, is here is this vision that John was, you know, was given to John by God. And then he describes all the, you know, amazing things that happen in this vision.
So what's the way that you would recommend approaching this book?
So I would think about it from two lenses. So have two things in your mind as you read Revelation. First thing is always remember what was the goal of the book. Any apocalyptic literature is written generally to people who are in some form of crisis, which the early church would have definitely been in crisis around the end of the first century. They're persecuted both by Jewish leadership and by the Romans. They're heretics to the Jews. They're a cult to the Romans. It's one of the hardest sections of persecution they've had yet. You know, at this point, the return of Jesus has gone longer than what most people expected. They expected him to come back, not like in a year, but like within the first generation or two, and they're starting to get towards the third generation of people since Jesus left the earth. And so it's like, is this really going to happen? So you have John writing to people who are persecuted, who are struggling, who are wondering, like, is there any hope? And saying to them, again, the last two chapters of Revelation are the two most important ones in there. It's like, here is the end game. Here's where all of this goes. You know, when we talked about this in season one of TLDR, the last two chapters of Revelation in many ways are a mirror to the first two chapters of the Bible.
I remember that episode. You got soups and mosh.
I did.
Which made me get a teensy bit.
Waterworks were going in here. It is the restoration of everything that was broken. And so whether you were a Jew with all of that backstory and all of the knowledge of everything your people had been through, or whether you were a Gentile convert kind of getting grafted into that story and recognizing like, oh, this is something big and cosmic that's happening here. Having that picture as like, doesn't matter what all the hurdles and jumps are that happen between now and whenever that happens. That's the hope. That's the end goal. So don't ever lose sight of that. Don't ever get so caught up in the what is it, what are the details of what I'm reading that you lose sight of. Here's the thing that actually matters. The other thing that I would say is, you know, almost take the faith element off the table for a second. Imagine that you have somebody that is trying to describe things that are vastly outside of the realm of everyday experience. Mm-hmm. Imagine for a second that aliens show up and you're the only one that sees them, and their ship moves in ways that are unlike anything you've ever seen. Their physiology is unlike any, and they, you know, even down to like the things inside their environment have colors and textures beyond that. You not only are they unfamiliar, it's like I don't even really have the words to describe it. We are talking about the spiritual realm being made physical and a cosmic battle between good and evil and God physically coming to earth and changing everything that we know of existence. How would you describe those sorts of things? There's armies as far as the eye can see, and creatures and statues and trumpets and noises, and like looking at it through the lens of this is a guy who's describing something that is beyond anything he's ever imagined or dreamed. Okay, then this sort of language makes sense. You're dealing with things at a cosmic scale. You're dealing with things that are inherently unknown and mysterious and difficult to wrap your head around. So you describe them with the language that you have, knowing that that language is going to fail you in some regards, if that makes sense.
It does. They were surprised and maybe anxious that they expected Jesus to come back, and it's three generations later and he hasn't. And now we're, I don't even know how many generations later, it's a couple thousand years.
Yep.
What do you think John would think if he just got teleported to where we are now and is saying, wait a second. It's been 2,000 and how many years? Like, what would they think about that?
I think he would be wildly overwhelmed by the world that he found himself in. But I don't get the impression from reading Revelation or from reading, you know, his gospel, which some people do or don't believe that the Gospel of John and Revelation are written by the same person. I do, but it's not a, you know, not a deal breaker. I don't get the impression from reading either of those that him finding out that it's been 2,000 years and Jesus still hasn't returned would be a deal breaker for him. Hmm. He'd seen too much. You know, and this is a guy who, like the rest of the disciples, experienced a decent amount of doubt and fear and disbelief, and he was there present with Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of his life, there's nothing that sways him. There's nothing that throws him off. And so he might be surprised that it's been this long, but I can't believe that it would have made him doubt what he believed to be true.
Okay, so it's really helpful for me to have context since I'm living in a completely different culture, a completely different world than this was written in. Life operates differently. Literature is different, all of that. So can you give me just a Cliff's Notes version, a short version on, tell me what's going on historically, what context do I need to know when I'm reading this book?
Sure. So the traditional understanding for Revelation is that John wrote it while he was imprisoned on the Isle of Patmos, near the very end of his life, probably 95, 96 AD.
Just sounds beautiful.
Patmos. Right.
Sounds it's a Greek island.
Yeah, it is. it's between Greece and Turkey.
But jail.
But jail.
Got it.
So as places to be in jail go, you could do a lot worse. It's not a Siberian gulag sort of situation.
Nice word.
Yeah, thank you. So at this time, you are 25 years past the destruction of Jerusalem by Rome. And that was a pretty, for both Christians and Jews, a pretty cataclysmic event. Under the Roman Empire, typically, when Rome would come in and take over a province, they would let people keep their religious beliefs and kind of keep as much of the social structure intact as they could, kind of so as to not stir up rebellions unnecessarily. But if you rebelled, then they would squash you. And so, like, in when the Jews started to rise up, that changed Judaism within the Roman Empire. Like, it was now outlawed. It was, they were much more oppressed. And so up until that point, the early church had kind of tried to position itself, at least in the eyes of Rome, as just kind of an offshoot of Judaism. Like, we're not some random cult. We're, we're a part of Judaism. And so, like, they were kind of left alone. You get some instances of localized persecution. You even see some of that in some of Paul's journeys where people would put him in jail for preaching and things like that. But by and large, the first two or three decades of the early church, they're kind of left alone. Once Jerusalem gets crushed, then, kind of all bets are off. So by 95, when John writes this, and even in the, kind of two or three decades after that, as Revelation is getting distributed, you're writing into a context of people are, like I said, wondering how long it's going to be before Jesus comes back, wondering how long they can keep going, feeling obviously persecuted, frustrated at, this is really hard. We're having to suffer. We're having to give up a lot. We're doing it willingly, but it's not easy. And so John is ultimately writing this, trying to acknowledge, like, here, this is hard, and it might get harder than it is now, but that's not the end of the story. So, like, they're living in a chaotic world, wondering what do we do about the persecution that we're feeling, wondering what we do about how do I feel about how long it's been, is this thing really going to happen, what do we do, In honesty, I would be willing to bet that you could ask these questions of somebody who in the modern world lives in a country where Christianity is persecuted. And they would look at Revelation much more similarly to how early Christians did. They would look at this and go, I see hope in that. Yeah, whatever. There's all that chaos that happens. I have all that chaos now. Like, that's not any different. What I see that's different than the world I live in is how the story ends.
The last two chapters.
The last two chapters.
Would you say people even need to read the rest of it, or should they just read the last two? Should they start at the end?
A, you absolutely should read the whole thing. If you've never read Revelation before, I'd read the last two chapters first, then go back and read the whole thing. Because it's so easy to get caught up in, you know, the imagery that's in this feels like a, you know, like a Netflix special. It feels
like Stranger Things.
It's Stranger Things meets Game of Thrones, really. It's yeah. It feels like that. There's dragons and fire and horns and
upside down.
You know, and all of this stuff, and it's incredible. You're like, man, Hollywood should make a movie out of this, except don't, because it'll be awful. You know?
Kirk Cameron already did.
We're not talking about that.
Okay. So, speaking of the stuff before the last two chapters, are you ready for a Revelation road trip?
Yes.
Get in the car. Turn the radio on.
It's the end of the world as we... Good. Are we right?
That was excellent. I'm proud of you. If I was close enough to high-five you, I would.
All right.
Here's the road trip. We're in the car. Here's how it starts. Letters to a bunch of different churches.
Okay.
Yep. What else do I need to know about that?
So this is still, despite it being very different from everything else in the New Testament, it's still a letter. And how these would have worked in the early church is, you know, Paul or John or Peter wrote a letter to a church. And that's why most of them are named after cities. Like, it was to the church in Galatia. It
was,
to the church in Ephesus. Or it's to Timothy, to Titus. Yeah. To, like, they're written to groups of people or to individuals. And then those letters, so like the church in Ephesus gets a letter from Paul and they'll read it and they'll talk about it and they'll dissect it and then make copies of it. And then Ephesus would take their letter, like, here, send this to Galatia. And Galatia, like, hey, here's the letter we just got from, like, and so there was a lot of, you know, these letters being distributed, but they were still letters from somebody to this place. Mm-hmm. And so the first part of Revelation is very much that sort of formula. It's John giving some introduction, talking about some of these things that he's seen, and then giving direct messages to seven different churches.
Mainly saying, I know you're being persecuted, and that's terrible.
Also,
it's probably going to get worse.
Also, get your crap in order.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of the churches that are largely just kind of praised. Most of them get at least a little bit of, you know, get your stuff together, a little bit of rebuke. There's a couple of them that it's like, what the heck are you doing? Kind of a slap across the mouth, sort of.
Yikes.
Yeah. And there's a couple of them that it's like, clearly things were not as they should be there. And so he kind of calls them out.
Okay. Next stop on the road trip, chapters 4 and 5, there's visions of heaven?
Yeah. So he transitions out of these direct messages to the churches and essentially starts what will be this kind of cohesive, consistent vision for the rest of the book. This is actually pretty relevant for understanding the book as a whole, that he starts with this picture of God, this picture of his throne room and the majesty and power that's associated with it. And it kind of kickstarts this whole thing by setting God up as proactively deciding, okay, it's time. You know, it's not all of this other stuff is happening and God just reacts and decides, oh, I guess we'll wind things down now. It's like, nope, it's time. Who's going to open the scroll? Who's going to do the, like, these very symbolic feeling things, but it's at God's initiative of saying, the time has come. Let's do the thing.
Okay. So recapping, he's saying, everybody get your stuff in order.
Yep.
Also reminding them there is a specific plan. This is not random. You are cared for. God is in control.
Yep.
Okay.
Also, everything's about to get crazy. Like,
yeah.
in those two chapters, you get a sense of, oh, this is this is stuff's about to get weird. Like, it's, you know, even though there's not all of the super weirdness that you're going to get next, you have standing in the throne room of God, you have these fantastical creatures and things with wings and eyes and all, like, so it's already like we're
a lot of eyes, right?
Yeah.
More than two.
Yeah. Okay. We're already into a strange sort of realm here.
Strange is right, because the next 12 chapters, it's so weird.
Yeah.
You've got the four horsemen.
Mm-hmm.
They're riding around.
Yep.
Bringing war, famine, and death. Then some stuff about some martyrs. There's the pregnant lady on a dragon or something. I mean, you tell me what all this is about. And I know we talked about he's describing something that he has absolutely no language for.
Sure.
But what's the purpose of, and that's a lot of chapters, 12 chapters of just not nonsense, but craziness.
Yeah. Horsemen and dragons and statues and bowls and trumpets and all of these sorts of things. Think of it almost like we're going to wind down human history.
Tell me more.
Imagine that tomorrow the end of the world is going to start.
Mm-hmm.
And take Revelation off the table for a second. What kinds of things would happen? You would imagine, you know, some sort of natural disaster happens over here, and there's a famine that happens over here, and riots happening over here, and, you know, these two countries are at war, and this, you know, this thing explodes, or, like, you have all just this increasing pace of disasters and crises and wars and all of this stuff happening, you know, in increasing speed. In some ways, kind of like what we feel, what the news looks like nowadays. Take that litany of events and imagine being able to see the spiritual reality that's happening beyond them. If you believe what the Bible describes, that there is a bigger spiritual reality beyond the physical that we see, and that there are forces and powers at work that we can't see with our physical eyes. And imagine for a second that John is seeing the end of the world and also can see those forces at work. What does he see? You know, he sees things creating natural disasters. He sees, you know, forces spurring things, you know, spurring nations to war and spurring people into fighting with each other and creating destruction and pulling things apart. And, like, you know, imagine that he could see suddenly this uptick in all of these spiritual entities doing things, different events, one right after another, that are creating this increasing level of chaos and calamity, almost with the sense of everything is coming apart. That's the message of these 12 chapters, is everything is coming apart. Everything is being unmade almost, you know. So you have all of this chaos and destruction happening. And then you also, on top of that, there's these moments, you know, the dragon and the woman and her child and all of that. You have these big moments that evoke earlier parts of the biblical story. You know, the woman that gives birth to a child and the dragon that tries to destroy that child. That seems an awful lot like it's evoking the story of Jesus, you know, especially given what's said about that child. You have these moments where, is this thing just a metaphor that's evoking something earlier? Is this an instance where the spiritual is in a sense operating on a different time frame than the just linear physical world is? Maybe. We don't know. Again, this is outside of our realm of knowledge. But to look at that, again, it's moments like that where God steps in and says, no, dragon, you will not consume this child. You know, this child is going to be your downfall, and protects it. Like, God continually stepping in and saying, no, you are ultimately not in control. You will not win this war. This war has already been won. You know, so in the midst of all of these tragedies and this unmaking of the world, you're building up to what culminates, you know, kind of the end of that section and the start of the next one in this kind of battle to end all battles, Armageddon, cosmic good versus evil thing. You know, when God steps in and, you know, ultimately destroys Satan and his forces and says, you know, this, you will never trouble my people again. And then we have kind of the end of the story where God comes back and the earth is renewed and the, you know, you have this picture of the city of Jerusalem coming down out of heaven. And, you know, this whole, like, all of this on the back of all of this destruction, you know, imagine every apocalyptic zombie movie ever where, you know, just everything is just a shell of itself and ruins and destruction everywhere. And then, you know, like, and it's just a pure mental picture, but it's like, imagine this, you know, city coming down out of the heavens, like, as it hits the earth, there's just this light that just kind of envelops and remakes everything. I don't know if that's how it's going to happen, but I can easily imagine that sort of thing being the kind of thing that does happen. It's clear that there is this ongoing battle that will come to a culmination, that God will ultimately win it, and that at the end of that battle, evil and death and destruction will be defeated forever, and God will remake this world.
That's the final two chapters.
Yeah.
That's the good stuff. The very first scripture we read at the top of the podcast mm-hmm. was saying that you're blessed if you read Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that why I should read it? I want to be blessed. So the takeaway I'm hearing from you is God wins in the end. He's winning right now, and it will be made abundantly clear, and everything is good all the time after that. Is there something else I should be getting from Revelation?
What matters about apocalyptic literature, Revelation especially, is it is this unique blend of prophecy, of God speaking to humanity and saying, here is the reality of the world. You know, when you had the prophets in the Old Testament, that was their job. That was what they did. Like, they heard from God. Here is what God says about the reality of who you are, where you are, what you're doing, why it's wrong, why it's good, like whatever it is. Like, the prophet was the voice of God, like kind of direct to the people. And so we think of prophecy as like telling something in the future, sort of. The main idea behind prophecy is like, this is what God says. This is the voice of God. You have this combination of the voice of God alongside this weird sort of historical narrative. So what that gets you, and any time you deal with something like Revelation, it ends up being God saying, let me pull back the curtain and show you the all of the picture. Let me show you the whole thing that's happening. Let me show you the parts that you couldn't see. Let me show you the forces that are all actually in play that you've never seen before. Here's all of this amazing, fantastical, frightening sort of stuff that's happening. And look, I am on top of every bit of it. I am in control of every bit of it. I will win at the end of it. Why that matters is if you shy away from it, it's one of the best places you will ever see that you can read and go, I can have confidence that there's not a single thing I'll encounter that God is not bigger than. My car broke down this last weekend. That's a pain in the neck. And if I'm stuck in the minutiae of my life, that feels really overwhelming because that's a big expense and we don't have the money for it. And what am I going to do? And you know, there are lots of people around the world that are facing much bigger crises than me. And it would be really easy for me to get caught up in that thing and wonder, like, is God going to show up? But if I read Revelation, I go, like, there's fire and dragons and wars and all these sorts of things. And God swats it away with a back of his hand. Whoosh, done. Oh, okay. I don't have to worry as much about the car. It's not that big a deal. And if you get so caught up in the minutiae of what does this mean and what does this go, you get stuck down in the weeds and you forget to step back and go, oh, wait, didn't matter what that beast was, what that city was, what that creature was, because God destroyed them. I'm stuck in trying to figure out a metaphor that ultimately was supposed to tell me God's bigger than this thing that's the metaphor. People absolutely should read it. But read it with the mindset of, I should walk away from this feeling hope. I should walk away from this knowing that it doesn't actually matter what horrible crises or misfortune faces me. The God that I'm following is bigger than that thing. And if you don't ever read Revelation, it's a lot harder to feel like that's the case. You know, you can look at the Gospels and you can obviously see that, but so much of the Gospels is centered around Jesus. It's really easy for us to mentally go, oh yeah, but that's Jesus. He's different. He's special. And you look at all the letters in the rest of the New Testament, and it's just, you know, a lot of it is encouragement on how to live and how to care for people and how to treat people and who God is. And like, all of that's good. But Revelation is this unique place where you see God's power and majesty and care and his cosmic mindset and capability on display. You know, so it's the place where more than anywhere else you are able to see him as, all of this stuff is playing out, but I am ultimately in control. And when I say it's done, it's done. And you don't see that anywhere else.
I have an honest question, or at least a question that I think someone might wonder. What if someone reads it and they still feel hopeless?
That's fair.
Like, that's probably somebody, right?
Sure, sure.
What do you tell that person, or what should that person know?
So I would tell that person, and I'll be honest, I'll tell myself on some days, mm-hmm. that hope is not a feeling. Mm. It's not. It's not a feeling. Mm. Much like, despite the way that we use it, love is not a feeling. Love is a choice. You know, it has feelings attached to it. There are emotions that go with it. But at its core, the deepest types of love are things that in English fall much more in the realm of commitment and choice. And like, you know, those, you look at those couples that have been married for 70 years and you go like, you didn't love, like, emotionally each other all 70 of those years. And they wouldn't tell you that they had. But you look at them and go, like, man, there's something different that happens when you make that choice for 70 years. It shapes you. It changes you. You become a different kind of person. That's what hope does. It's not – hope is not this – I'm going to feel good and everything's going to work out and it's going to be okay. And I'm going to feel great tomorrow. Dang it. Like, everything will be better. Yeah, maybe. Eventually, in the long game, yes, everything will be better. But that's not hope. Hope is, I have put my trust in this, in the case of those who are following, I have put my hope in God. And I am making the intentional choice to decide that I will place my mental sanity and my emotional well-being on the idea that God will be who he has said he will be. And that at the end of the day, he will care for me. He will provide for me. And that when all of this stuff in Revelation happens, he will carry me through it. That is hope. It is that mental choice to say, this is where I put my faith. This is what I hope in. There will be lots of days where you feel very hopeful. And mm-hmm. by that, I mean you feel optimistic that things are going to be good in the future. Mm-hmm. You will have lots of days where you feel like you have no hope. And in reality, when you feel pessimistic that things are going to be better tomorrow. You feel like they're going to be worse. Mm-hmm. Neither of those feelings is actually hope.
That's right. I just wanted to say that because Latasha says that on IKR.
You know, neither of those things is actually hope.
Yeah.
You know, hope is that is that intentional choice? And you can hope in a lot of different things. To put another spin on the question of a lot of the New Testament is, what is your hope in? Mm. You know, the question that John honestly would say to a lot of our culture is the thing you're hoping in going to pan out? Is it going to come good? You know, you're hoping in this career to make you happy, but what if you get fired? You're hoping in this relationship to make you satisfied, but what if you break up? What if that person gets killed in a car accident? If the hope for your ultimate future is in something less than God, then at some point that thing is going to let you down. The point of Revelation is to show you that very end so that you can say, look, even all the way down here, you hope in him and you will not be disappointed. You know, and I think that's why you need Revelation. That's why you need to read Revelation, is to see, like, things can get really bad. You know, read Revelation, read the stories, even in our modern times, like read the stories of what followers of Jesus go through in countries that are far more oppressive than ours. Like, you know, it is miserable circumstances for many, many people that follow Jesus. We are extremely blessed. But our hope isn't in the fact that we're blessed now. Their hope isn't in maybe someday we won't be so oppressed. I'm sure they would love that. If I was them, I would love that. But I'm not putting my hope in getting out from underneath this oppression. Because it might not happen. And even if it does, that doesn't mean that I'm suddenly better off or I'm suddenly happy. You know, my hope is in God himself. You know, so if you look at the beginning of this book and it says that those who read it will be blessed, that those who hear it will be blessed, who keep what's written in it. If you're living through the events that are described in here or anything that's like them, you're not going to feel like you're blessed. You know, so clearly it's not the description of what's happening in here that John's talking about. He's talking about, this is a picture of the power and majesty of God. And so to know that this is the power of God, this is how big he is, this is what he's capable of, you are blessed in that because you, A, understand at a deeper level who God is. And also because when you endure difficulty and hardship, whether it's what's described in Revelation or it's something else, you can have confidence that this thing is temporary. This misfortune, this difficulty, this hardship will not last forever. It does not define me. It will not consume me. You know, I follow a God that is much bigger than this. To have that sort of framework for life enables you to go into almost any hardship and not be consumed by it, not be destroyed by it. You know, it's the kind of mindset that you see in survivors of concentration camps and things like that. Like there were people that died not in the gas chambers, but just of despair. You know, of there is no way out, there is no hope. And one of the things that was consistent across survivor after survivor is this, and not just of concentration camps, but of other similar sorts of experiences, was this idea that this thing is not the end. This moment, even if I die here, this is not the end. There's more to life than this. There's something bigger. To be able to endure difficulty with that kind of mindset, that's a blessing. To be destroyed physically is one thing, you know, and I don't wish that on myself or on anyone else. But it feels, I'd much rather have that than just the absolute loss of hope, the absolute loss of meaning and purpose. Yeah, so having a purpose and a meaning that can't be shaken, that's its own kind of blessing, I think.
I'm going to take scripture up on its offer. I would encourage everybody else to read the book of Revelation for yourself, but Instead of trying to decode it, look for the overarching themes. Here's one you can't miss. God wins in the end. And that's pretty freaking sweet news. As you're reading it, let us know what you're thinking and processing. Reach out to us both through email at podcasts@crossroads.net. We'd love to continue the conversation with you. And if you like what you hear, share this podcast with a friend. We'll see you soon for season 3 of Too Long Didn't Read. Too Long Didn't Read is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio. That's a rapture.